All right, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in 2 Kings. We left off in chapter 12. You know, we haven't been here for 2 weeks because of the Christmas holiday, so just to give you a brief overview of chapter 11, simply because it leads right into this chapter 12. And what we're doing right now, we're going through this 2 Kings, and what's happening in the book of Kings and also in the Chronicles is that you see a situation where Israel, the nation of Israel, has been divided. There's a northern kingdom, there's a southern kingdom, and sometimes it can get pretty confusing. As a matter of fact, if I get a chance, what I want to do is starting next week, I'm going to have a whole chart made up and to show you a list of all the kings that reigned in the southern kingdom and all the kings that reigned in the northern kingdom. And I'll put the dates of their reign and who was reigning at what time, because there was a king reigning in the south and a king reigning in the north. So it really can get kind of confusing when you go back and forth and back and forth. And that's what 2 Kings and Chronicles does. All right, but if I'm not mistaken, and when I make this chart, I'll clarify everything, but if I'm not mistaken, in the southern kingdom, there was about 22 kings that reigned in the southern kingdom. And out of that 22 kings, I think there was only around 8 or so that were classified as good kings in the eyes of God. And the whole standard of goodness in God's sight was basically David. He set the standard. And even though David had made some horrendous mistakes and really blew it pretty bad, nevertheless, God in his graciousness said, well, this is my standard, because David loved God with his whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and he did everything he could except on a couple occasions he really blew it, but he did everything he could to honor God and to glorify God, and God was well pleased with that. And that was basically the standard of which God judged all these other kings, north and south, yeah.
And he was the second king of Israel before they split.
Right.
After Saul.
Right. That's a good point, too. All right. Because there was, you know, Saul, and then it was David, and then, of course, Solomon came, and then it was because of Solomon that the kingdom ended up being split. But that was the standard. And like I said, in the northern kingdom, I think there was like 20 kings. Around 20, and none of them were any good as far as God was concerned. And that's what we're going to be dealing with tonight. We're going to be dealing with one of the kings in the southern kingdom that started out really well, and I think there's a lot of things to be gleaned from it, because he didn't finish too well at all. But anyway, in getting into this chapter 12, if you remember from a couple of weeks ago when we were going through chapter 11, in the northern kingdom they had two of the most wicked people that were running the northern kingdom. You had Ahab and then his notoriously wicked wife Jezebel. They led that whole northern kingdom into idolatry and to Baal worship, and they had a daughter named Athaliah. And she ended up marrying one of the king's sons down there in the southern tribes. And this Athaliah, she ended up killing her own relatives, her own grandchildren, in order to secure the throne in the south. And she had all of the descendants of David murdered. And one little boy was this little child who was about a year old. His name was Joash. He was saved by his aunt, if I'm not mistaken. And anyway, he was hidden from this wicked queen for about 6 years or so. And because when the child became 7 years old, then the priest brought him out and they crowned him king when he was 7 years old. And that's where this story basically picks up. And they ended up executing this Athaliah. So beginning with verse 1 in chapter 12, it says, in the seventh year of Jehu, now this Jehu was the king of the north, Jehoash. Now Jehoash is the same guy as Joash, okay? The spelling's a little bit different and the pronunciation is a little bit different, but it's the same seven-year-old kid who became king. Jehoash became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. Then Jehoash said to the priests, all the money of the sacred things which are brought into the house of the Lord in current money, both money of each man's assessment and all the money which any man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it for themselves, each from his acquaintance, and they shall repair the damages of the house wherever any damage may be found. And it came about that in the 23rd year of the king Jehoash, that the priests had not repaired the damages of the house. Then the king Jehoash called for Jehoiada the priest and for the other priest, and said to them, why do you not repair the damages of the house? Now therefore take no more money from your acquaintances, but pay it for the damages of the house. So the priest agreed that they should take no more money from the people or repair the damages of the house. But Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bore a hole in its lid and put it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord. And the priest who guarded the threshold put it all in the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. And when they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribes and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. And they gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and to the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons, to the stonecutters, and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damages of the house of the Lord, and for all that was laid out for the house to repair it. But they were not made for the house of the Lord silver cups or snuffers or bowls or trumpets or any vessels of gold or vessels of silver from the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. For they gave that to those who did the work, and with it they repaired the house of the Lord. Moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men in whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. The money from the guilt offerings and the money for the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It was for the priest. Now, before we go any further, I wanted to read this far down because it's dealing with this King Joash. And like I said, it's also spelled and pronounced Jehoash. Anyway, this was the little kid who became king. And he started out really, really well. We're not going to get this kind of insight from this simply reading this 2 Kings chapter 12, because I think if we couple it together with 2 Chronicles chapter 14, we're going to get a better insight as to exactly what happened to this king. But he starts out really well because he's under the leadership of this high priest at that particular time, who was Jehoiada. And he was the high priest, and he instructed him in the ways of the Lord, and he brought him up in the ways of the Lord. And as long as Jehoiada was alive, Joash was a very good king, and he followed the instructions of the high priest. But when we start reading some of the accounts that are listed in the Chronicles, we're going to find out that he didn't finish well at all as far as his kingship is concerned, as far as his loyalty to God is concerned. But before we get into that, let's just back up a minute, because what's happened here is because this Queen Athaliah had introduced all kinds of Baal worship and all kinds of idolatrous practices down there in the southern part of Jerusalem, or Israel, the whole house of God was in disarray. It was in need of a great deal of repair. All right. Now, what does Peter tell us in 2 Peter? He's the one that tells us about what the modern-day temple is. Okay, in the modern-day temple is basically the Church of God, because if you read in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter says this. He says, and coming to him, that's coming to Christ, is a living stone rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God. You also are living stones and are being built up as a spiritual house for the holy priesthood to offer up the spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ Jesus. And then it goes on to basically say that Christ is the chief cornerstone. He was rejected by the builders. But what Peter is telling us is this. You know what the temple of God is today? The temple of God is the church of God. The temple of God are the people of God. We're all living stones that are being built up into God's house. And look at that way the church is in disrepair today. I mean, it's in bad shape today as far as morally, spiritually. So many churches have thrown overboard their moral compass as far as God's word is concerned, and they're basically doing their own thing, and everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. And I say everybody, I mean a great number of people who even attend church or profess to be Christian or profess to belong to Christ or profess to follow Christ. They're basically doing what they feel is right to them, rather than following what God has clearly said. So anyway, when we're talking about the temple of God today, it still has an application for us right now. And God wants to use us to repair his church today. And what I mean by repair his church, I mean to go out there and to try to build up people in the faith, to try to encourage people in their walk with Christ, and try to get back people who are way off in left field as far as their doctrine, as far as their lifestyles are concerned, as far as their commitment to Christ, to get them back into the fold, to get them back into following Christ with a pure heart, and to follow him with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength. And that's what the repairing of the temple is today. But here with this guy, Joash, I mean, he really, as a little kid, he had a heart for God. And what did he do? He went out there, he made a proclamation. He told the priest to go out there the Levites to go out and collect money to rebuild the house of God, to refurbish it, or basically to build it back up, because it was about 200 years since Solomon had built the temple, and now it just has gone to pot. This is the thing that we've got to understand something, that we're all living under the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything always goes from the complex to the simple. It breaks down, deteriorates, falls apart, and dies. I mean, you take this house here, you don't have to take a stick of dynamite to this house to make a complete shambles of it within 50 years. Just don't touch the house. Don't do anything to the house. And I guarantee you, the encroachment of the wilderness, the weather, and all kinds of different things are going to just completely turn this house into nothing but a dilapidated wreck. Why? Because of the second law of thermodynamics. If it's left to itself, everything's just going to fall apart and decay. And that includes the Church of God. That includes the Temple of God. We have to constantly be diligent in maintaining our spiritual walk and our commitment to Christ, and even, you know, this whole idea of repairing the temple. The temple really was pointing to the Temple of God as far as his people are concerned. So what does he do? Joash, he goes out there and tells the priest to collect the money for the repair of the temple. But what did the priests do? They're taking their time. We'll read the account that's there listed in Chronicles, but it says that they were basically being lax as far as their commitment is concerned. But a lot of the money that they were collecting, apparently they were using it for their own needs. And you know, priests had a right to do that because they were to be paid the treasury for their service. However, the money that was needed for the repairs of the building wasn't being set aside. So this is what Joash did. What he did is he put a big chest right there at the entrance of the temple, and he put a big hole on the top of it, and he had people contribute solely for the rebuilding of the temple. And that thing, you know, it caught on. It caught on to the point where people were just putting all kinds of money into that treasury chest, and then it filled up. And they emptied it out, put it in their bags, and they filled it up again, and they filled it up again. That money was just set aside for repairing the temple. But what's kind of interesting is, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but remember when we went through the Gospel of Mark, went through the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus talked about the treasury? As a matter of fact, let me just read one of the accounts so that you know, you'll know what I'm talking about here. I'll just read the one in Luke. But in Luke chapter 21, it says, this is Jesus, and Jesus looked up, or he looked up, and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a certain poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them, for they out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on. And what I get the impression here is that it was because of Joash that this whole tradition started as far as having a treasury box there, all right, that was set aside in the temple place, and it was supposed to be used for the repairing of the temple. And Jesus was sitting opposite that treasury box that Joash had instituted centuries later, and he's observing what people are putting into the treasury box. And what does that tell you, spiritually speaking? I mean, to me, what it says to me is, you know what, God really takes note of the money that we give for his namesake. It really does. A lot of times people, you know, can't give God the time of day, and they're certainly not going to give him two nickels as far as the work of his house is concerned. But Jesus, sitting opposite the treasury here, took note of that. And what he took note of wasn't so much the amount that the person was putting in, but the attitude of the heart and the quality of what they were putting in. That widow had only put in the equivalent of 1 cent, but he said, you know what, she's put in more than all the rest because that was all she had. But a couple other things to just kind of keep in mind, too. But it's been a long time since we went through the book of Haggai, but I think that when we went through that, it says something about that, too, because when we went through the book of Haggai, that was a situation where the people had come back from exile because God sent them into exile because of their wickedness. And then when they came back, they started to rebuild the temple. And they only got the foundation laid, and they ran into all kinds of problems. And the people said, oh, the heck with it. We're not going to bother with this building this temple. It's just not God's timing. And God had to end up sending them a prophet by the name of Haggai to basically rebuke them when people left his temple lie in disarray. Because in the book of Haggai, when we went through that, in the first chapter, God said this. He says, then the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in paneled houses while this house lies desolate? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much, but you have harvested little. You eat, but there is not enough to be satisfied. You drink, but there is not enough to get drunk. you put on clothing, but no one is warm enough, and he who earns wages to put into a purse with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways, go up into the mountains and bring wood and rebuild the temple that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says the Lord. You look for much, but behold, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why, declares the Lord of hosts? Because of my house, which lies desolate, which each of you runs to his own house. Therefore, because of you, the sky has withheld its rain and the earth has withheld its produce. I call for a drought upon the land and on the mountains, on the grain and on the new wine and on the oil, and on what the ground produces, and on men and on cattle, and all the labor of your hands. And then it goes on, basically says that Zerubbabel, Haggai, and Zechariah got people motivated to start building the house of the Lord. And when they did, then God turned around and blessed them. But what's kind of interesting here is that look at how we are suffering today as far as financial aid is concerned. Look how far we're in debt, individually and collectively and as a nation. You know what I'm saying? And people can never see the reason for it. And the reason for it, you know why? We've neglected God and the things of God. You know, what's kind of interesting is you go back in the Old Testament, you know what God had said through Moses? He said, if my people will obey me, if they obey me, he says, there's not going to be any poor among you. That's what God said. Interesting thing, though, when Jesus came along, and then remember that woman who poured ointment all over Jesus, and then the disciples, especially Judas, became indignant about that and said, hey man, this is a total waste. They could have taken this money of this very precious ointment and sold it for 300 denarii and given it to the poor. What did Jesus say? Anybody remember? The poor you always have with you, but me you won't always have with you. In other words, this woman who poured out this costly ointment, and this ointment, she probably had saved up for that for her whole life. That probably was something that she was going to use on her wedding night or something. That was something that was so precious. But she poured it all out on Jesus, you know, because she saw the worth of Jesus. So she gave her best for him. And then the other people became indignant. But what's interesting is Jesus said, hey, the poor you will always have with you. But God said, if you obey me, there won't be any poor. Look at all the poor in the world today. People are living in abject poverty and grinding misery. But you know what? There wouldn't be any poor today if everybody in this world obeyed God. Nobody thinks about that, do they? They never get to the root problem. All right? They never see the real root problem, that if we all obeyed God, there wouldn't be any poor among us. Isn't that amazing? I believe that 100%. And I'm not preaching the gospel of health, wealth, and prosperity here. I'm preaching obedience. If we obey God, how he will bless us. And you see a situation I just read from Haggai. God said this, man, you're leaving my temple laying in total ruins, and you're running home to your house and paneling them and spending all this money on your own self. And so therefore, hey, I'm not blessing you. And the money you make, you got purses or pockets with holes in it. Your money's going right through it, right? And he's basically saying, what you accumulate, I just blow it away. He says, I sent a drought upon the land and this type of thing. Well, look, that's what's happening to us. But people never seem to see things spiritually. They always say, hey, this is a problem. But you always got to say, hey, you know what? That's the symptom. What is the real problem? What is the root problem? What is the cause of this? But people never get to the cause. God said, if you consider your ways and put me first in what you do, you know, then I'll end up blessing you. Well, this guy, Joash, this king, he put God first. You know, and it was very important to him to have this temple repaired. And so he got the whole thing moving and made a big difference. But even the way they dealt with the money, because they took the money and they made sure, hey, this money is not going to any administrative costs. This money is set aside specifically for what? For the carpenters, for the masoners, for the stone cutters, for the people who do the work, and for all the materials, all right? They cut out the middleman. They said to the priest, look, this money over here in this box, that belongs to totally, that's set aside for the total repair of the temple. And it's not to be given out for salaries for priests or anything like that. That's totally separate. And anyway, that's the way they did the work. And, you know, even the people that they had doing the work, they made sure that these people were very, very honest. They were men of integrity, and therefore they didn't have an accounting there. It would have been, to me, a wise type of stewardship to make sure there was an accounting, but they made sure that the men that they had were men that were reliable, men that were honest, they were trustworthy. Yeah.
Now, at this point, they're referring to Solomon's temple still.
Right. It's Solomon's temple. Like I said, it's about 200 years after Solomon, and the whole temple has gone into disarray. And one of the biggest reasons why it went into such disarray is when Athaliah, who was the daughter of Jezebel and Ahab, she married Joram down there in the southern kingdom, and a lot of her followers just trashed the temple of God, took away everything that was valuable, and they took it over to their temple of Baal. So that's one of the reasons why this temple would need such repair at that particular time. Anyway, what I want to do is I want to finish this chapter up real quick, and then what I want to do, I want to read the account in Chronicles, because it parallels this, and there's a lot more information that's given as far as this character Joash is concerned that I think is very, very insightful and very, very instructive. But anyway, look at this verse 17. It says, "Then Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and captured it, and Hazael set his face to go up against Jerusalem. And Joash, the king of Judah, took all of the sacred things that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his father, kings of Judah, had dedicated in his own sacred things, and all of the gold that was found among the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent it to Hazael, king of Syria. Then he went away from Jerusalem." Now, this is bizarre to me, that here you got a situation, you got this God-hating Hazael, who's Assyrian, and he went all the way down into Israel, he went all the way down to Gath, and I don't know if you can see it on this map here, but Syria is way up here is Damascus, that's the capital of Syria. This guy Hazael, he comes all the way down here to the Philistine cities on the coast of the Mediterranean. He's all the way down there, kicking the snot out of the Philistines and just plundering them. And he decides, well, on the way back to Damascus, I'm just going to attack Jerusalem and just plunder them too. And so when Joash gets word of this, he buys him off. And how does he buy him off? He takes all the money that was in the temple treasury, and he said, "Here, have this money and we'll just leave us alone." And so Hazael did. He just took the money and went home. And to me, I don't understand that, because it kind of gives you an insight of Joash that he was a good man as long as he had a good spiritual leader that was showing him what to do. But here, I think he really makes a big mistake. I live by this scripture in Proverbs 3:5. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths." In other words, I don't think Joash did this. I don't think that he sought God in this. I don't think that he sought the counsel of God in this. I just feel like well, the expedient thing to do is to buy off this Hazael, king of Assyria, so that he won't come into Jerusalem, and I won't have to go to war with him. But I really think that he should have sought God's face, because God could have dealt with him, and he wouldn't have had to give God's money away. I mean, isn't that kind of ironic? It is to me that he would make such a big mistake, but when we get into reading the account of him in Chronicles, I think we could see why. But anyway, beginning at verse 19, he says, "And now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And his servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash at the house of Milo as he was going down to Silo. For Josachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servant, struck him, and he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah, his son, became king in his place." Now, that's all the information that we've given about Joash in this particular chapter. All right, but we can't really read the 2 Kings chapter 12 without reading 2 Chronicles chapter 24. So I want everybody just to turn to there. If you can't find it, don't worry about it, because I'll just go ahead and read from it. But we got to get a better view or a better insight into this Joash, because a lot of the information is left out in the 2 Kings that could give us, a false impression of Joash. So, beginning with this, chapter 24 in 2 Chronicles, it says this: "Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Ziba from Beersheba. And Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest." Now, that's the key there, all right? He became king when he was 7 years old. Apparently, he had a godly mother, because usually the mothers aren't the ones that are mentioned there. But he had a godly mother. But more importantly, he had a high priest there that was the one that basically led him in all of the ways of the Lord. You know, it says Jehoiada, he was the priest, and as long as he was alive, Joash did well. Now, here's the thing we got to understand about this, and I think it's very, very instructive when we read this account in chapter 24 of Chronicles, is that Joash apparently did not have a real grounded personal relationship with God that stood on its own. In other words, he was dependent upon somebody else as far as his spiritual strength was concerned. And this is why this chapter is so important. That's why I'm going to go through this. It's because this can happen to a lot of people. Can you think of one person in your life that has been the most instrumental for you spiritually speaking? Is it your pastor? Is it your minister? Is it your priest? Is it your Bible study teacher? Who is it in your life that has really been the bedrock, the giant oak tree in your life as far as your spiritual commitment to Christ is concerned? Maybe there's nobody, or maybe there is some person. Think about it for a second. Then I got to ask a question I want to ask you. What's going to happen to your faith if that person dies? Or worse yet, what's going to happen to your faith in God if that person really blows it? If that person ends up becoming shipwrecked as far as your own commitment? Because I'm telling you right now, if his stumbling or his failure, or his faults or his shortcomings or whatever causes your faith to falter in such a way that you turn your back on God or you're no longer committed to God, then there's something wrong with your faith. Right?
Your faith was in him and not in Jesus.
Good point. Exactly where I'm coming from. All right, you said it. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Is that don't ever put your faith in a person. All right, now, God sends us people into our lives to help us along, to instruct us, to encourage us, to inspire us, to motivate us, to that type of thing. But if you put your whole faith in that person, and that person either ups and dies, or worse yet, blows it in their faith, what's going to happen to you? This is why I wanted to stress this is about this Joash, because of what's happening here. Because look at that verse 2. It says, "And Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. And Jehoiada took two wives for him, and he became the father of sons and daughters. Now it came about after this that Joash decided to restore the house of the Lord. And he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, 'Go out into the cities of Judah and collect money from all of Israel to repair the house of your God annually, and that you shall do the matter quickly.' But the Levites did not act quickly, so the king summoned Jehoiada, the chief priest, and said to him, 'Why have you not required the Levites to bring in from Judah and from Jerusalem the levy fixed by Moses, the servant of the Lord, for the congregation of Israel for the tent of the testimony? For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the bills.'" Now see, we didn't read this, a little bit of information in 1 Kings, right? This is another reason why the house of the Lord was in such disarray. Why? Because we look at verse 7. "For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy thing for the house of the Lord for their Baals." In other words, you know, they just trashed the temple and they took a lot of the expensive utensils in the temple of God and they're using it for this false idol worship, right? Then in verse 8 it says, "So the king commanded and they made a chest and set it outside the gate of the house of the Lord." Now see, this, look at this king. He's really motivated. He's really doing some excellent thing, isn't he? Look at that verse 9. It says, "And they made a proclamation in Judah and Jerusalem to bring to the Lord the levy fixed by Moses, the servant of God of Israel, in the wilderness. And all the officers and all the people rejoiced and brought in their levies and dropped them into the chest until they had finished. And it came about, whenever the chest was brought into the king's officers by the Levites, and when they saw that there was much money, then the king's scribes and the chief priests and officers would come in into the chest and take it and return it to its place. Thus they did daily and collected much money. And the king and Jehoiada gave it to those who did the work of the service of the house of the Lord. And they hired masons and carpenters to restore the house of the Lord, and also the workers in iron and bronze to repair the house of the Lord. So the workmen labored, and the repair work progressed in their hands, and they restored the house of God according to its specifications and strengthened it. And when they had finished, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada. And it was made into utensils for the house of the Lord, and utensils for the service and the burnt offerings, and the pans and the utensils and gold and of silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. And now when Jehoiada reached a ripe old age, he died, and he was 130 years old at his death. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done well in Israel and to God and his house." Now see, this is a godly man. He lived a ripe old age. He lived to be 130 years old. But he was the bedrock for Joash as far as his faith was concerned. Because look at all the good things that Joash has done here since a little boy. He motivated and inspired the entire kingdom to get behind repairing the temple. But now this old man dies. Now, this is what really is instructive to me, and really, I think, it's a sad commentary, because look at that verse 17. But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them, and they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols, so that the wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for their guilt. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. Though they testified against them, they would not listen. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, "Thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has also forsaken you." So they conspired against him at the command of the king, and they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord. Now look what happened here. Who was this Zechariah? Whose son is he? In other words, Jehoiada was the one who saved the little boy's life. It was his Jehoiada's sister who saved the little boy's life when he was an infant. It was Jehoiada who was a high priest. He brought up Joash as a little boy. He instructed him in all the ways of God. Now, Joash ends up killing Jehoiada's son. When his son does what? He stands up and proclaims this bad news against the king and his house. You know, look, go back to that verse 17. But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. In other words, what happened here? The high priest dies, Jehoiada dies, and then these officials, these politicians, they come up to the king and they pressure him. They say, "Hey, man, don't become so fanatical. Don't become such an extremist. You know, we need to be more inclusive and more tolerant and more accepting," and so on and so forth. So they started including these other gods, these Asherim and these other deities. Okay? And so he started leading people astray because of the pressure that's put on him. So the guy didn't have a backbone. He was spineless. And in my opinion, he should have had enough spiritual gumption to say, "Hey, you know, you guys all go to hell. I'm not going to do that. There's only one God, and he's the true God. We're going to serve him. You don't like it, you take a hike." You know. Instead, what's happened here? He's swayed by these people. They pressure him into doing what? To doing something that was obviously a violation of his own conscience, because look at that verse 18. "And they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and they served the Asherim." What's the Asherim? It's a female deity. What's our Asherim today?
Sex.
Yeah, the goddess of sex. This is foretold by Paul that in the last days that people will be lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. And when we do that, look on any advertisement. I don't care if they're selling 50 pounds of steer manure. You're going to see a half-naked lady on top of there. And you wonder, well, what's the connection? There is no connection, but sex sells. This is the Asherim today, right? This is what I'm saying. This is what we put before God. Well, 1,000 years have come and gone, and nothing's really changed. But anyway, they abandoned God. And what do? They set up to serve the Asherim and the idols. In other words, they didn't really forsake God. It says they abandoned him. In other words, they turned their back on him, but they still gave him the lip service. They just wanted to include all these other things along with it. And so what happens here? Then what did God do? In that verse 19, he says he sends them prophets. Look at that verse 19. "Yet he," that's God, "sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. Though they testified against him, they would not listen." Isn't that just happening today? Nothing's changed. I mean, it happens time and time and time and time again. When God's people get away from God, they start drifting away. God will send his prophets. He will send his ministers. He will send his priests. He will send his teachers. He will send people to try to get him back. But what happens? Very often, the very people that God sends to try to get people back on the straight and narrow, they're resented. They're hated. They're despised. You know, they're called fanatical. They're called hateful. They're called everything in the book. You know, that's all there is to it. They really are. And then verse 20 says, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada." All right, now what does he do? You know, he goes out there and he stands above all the people and says to them, "Thus God said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper?" In other words, they're not prospering. Why? Because they're not being obedient. And what did I just say? Earlier, I said that God said through Moses, "If my people will obey me, there won't be any poor among you." Well, the people aren't prospering because they're not obeying God. And then he says here, "Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has also forsaken you." Now I'm going to repeat that. And I'm going to apply this to this country. All right, because there's no doubt in my mind this is exactly what happened to us. He says, "Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you." All right. Now, imagine I'm a politician. Okay, we got the elections coming up this year. All right. You know, you see all these people that are just clawing to become president. Don't ask me why. They want their 15 minutes of fame, but they will just cut their own mother's throat to get there for whatever reason. I don't know. But let's just say, you know, that one of these politicians has the guts to stand up and say, "You know what, America? you know what? We have forsaken God, therefore he has forsaken us. What's going to happen to him? Look what happened to this poor guy. Look at verse 21. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king. Who's the king?
Joash,
of all people. They stoned him to death at the court of the house of the Lord. Now, look at that. That's why I insisted upon reading this chapter along with 1 Kings. Because you don't get this from 1 Kings, do you? Or 2 Kings, rather. You don't get it, right? You got to read the whole account here. Because if you just read 2 Kings chapter 12, you get a totally different concept of this guy. Because this fills in between the lines. And you see, this guy started out really well. But when the bedrock of his faith, the man who, I guess, so motivated in his life, upped and died, his faith all went to pot. And we got to ask ourselves, hey, do we put our faith in another human being, or are we going to put it in God? All right? Who's the person that is most influential in your life spiritually? If that person ups and dies, or like I said, worse yet, he gets spiritually shipwrecked, is that going to shipwreck your faith? Because if it does, it shows you put your faith in that person and not in God. And so he says here in that verse 22, so thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. Now his son is Zechariah. And as he died, as Zechariah died, he said, may the Lord see and avenge. Okay, now just finish these last few verses and we'll close for tonight. In verse 23 it says, now it came about at the turn of the year that the army of the Syrians came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem, destroyed all the officials of the people from among the people, and sent all their spoils to the king of Damascus. Now look what happened because of Joash's wickedness. God punishes them by doing what? Bringing war upon them, and they're being plundered. He says here in verse 24, indeed, the army of the Syrians came with a small number of men, and yet the Lord delivered the very great army into their hands because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. Now, look at that. The Syrians had a small army of men, but they overran the stronger army of Judah. Because why? Because it was God who did it. Look at that there in verse 24. Indeed, the army of the Syrians came with a small number of men, yet the Lord delivered a very great army into their hands. Look what happened. We got these cave dwellers that came over here and ran these planes into our twin towers. All right? Did anybody ever consider for 1 minute that these towers would come down in less than an hour? No. By who? It wasn't a nation more powerful than us. It was a band of terrorists. We were determined to bring us down. And God let him. Why? Well, it says in the Psalms, it says that unless the Lord guards a city, the watchmen do no good. And in the book of Amos, it says, if disaster strikes a city, has not the Lord caused it? It was a disaster that happened. Why did he do it? Because of our wickedness, right? Because it says here, thus they executed judgment on Joash. And then look at that verse 25. And when they had departed from him, for they left him very sick, his own servants conspired against him because of the blood of his son Jehoiada the priest, and murdered him on his bed. So he died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the king. Look what happened to this guy. Look at the difference. He started out so well. 7 years old, he started out really good, didn't he? He had a heart for God. He went out there and beat the drums to get money to rebuild the house of God. He did all these things. Then the bedrock of his faith, the old man dies, and then what happens? He's buffaloed by these politicians and say, no, we need to do it this way, we need to do that way. This guy didn't have a backbone or spine to say, no, I'm king, this is the way we're doing it. You guys go take a hike. He let these people persuade him, and then you could see his true colors coming out. That in the end, he murdered Jehoiada's son, and then he brings this judgment upon himself. Where what happens? When apparently the enemies, the Syrians, came down, they overran him, and what happened? Joash, it says that he was basically on a sick bed, so I get the impression that he was wounded. But what happened to him when he was wounded? He's laying there trying to recover, and what happens? Who kills
his
him?
Own people?
His own people kill him. Look at that verse. Verse 25, and when they had departed from him, for they left him very sick, the Syrians left him very sick. In other words, they probably wounded him. His own servants conspired against him because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada the priest, and murdered him on his bed. This was his end. Isn't that a shame? Now, when we read that account in 2 Kings, we never would have got this, right? We would have concluded, well, the guy was a good king. He started out really well, but look at the end. He was shipwrecked at the end. So he died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. So, in other words, he wasn't given that honor. because of what he did. And then it says in verse 26, now these are those who have conspired against him. Zabad, the son of Shimeath-eth, and the Ammonitess, and Jehoshabad, the son of Shimrith, the Moabitess. So, in other words, these two guys, they were sons of who? They were Moabites and Ammonites. Ammonites and Moabites, they basically are people who claim to have an inheritance. In other words, claim to believe in God, claim to believe in Jesus, but what? They're trying to have an inheritance their own way. In other words, they want to get saved their own way. They want to follow God their own way and do things their way. When we first read about the high places, and when we're reading so much about the high places, what are we told in Corinthians? 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says this, but I am afraid, at least as a serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your mind should be led astray from the simplicity of purity to devotion to Christ. For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom you have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. In other words, what he's saying is, you know, there could be a different Jesus, a different gospel, a different spirit, and people bear this beautifully, right? That's the modern-day Ammonites and Moabites. But not only that, we're dealing with all these high places that these kings haven't dealt with. And what is a high place? You know, God forbid anybody to go worship any place but the place he chose. But what happened? A lot of people say, well, there's a hill there. There's a mountain there. We'll go offer God sacrifices up there. And they say, well, we're offering the one true God. But it's basically an amalgamation of these other beliefs that are incorporated into their worship. And they become a pagan kind of worship, all right? I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but, you know, Paul tells us in Galatians chapter 1, he said this, he says, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another, only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. What is this what happened to Joash? Now, even though this was before Christ, it was still, they distorted it, right, as far as the one true God was concerned. And then Paul says this, but even though we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what you have preached to you, let him be accursed. And then he goes on and says it again. I'm saying it again. Anybody who preaches to you a different gospel, let him be accursed. Well, Jehoiada, the high priest, was preaching the right gospel. In other words, even though it was the Old Testament, he was preaching the right way. But then what happened when he died? These other guys come in here and, like I said, Joash is, they flim-flam Joash, or just basically, you know, he's got no spine, no backbone as far as his own spiritual condition is concerned. So he goes off for another gospel, another spirit, that type of thing. And look at the end result here. He's not even given a burial with the kings. And that last verse of 27 of 2 Chronicles 24 says, and to his sons and to many oracles against him in the rebuilding of the house of God, behold, other than that written in the theses of the book of Kings, then Amaziah, his son, became king in his place. Don't you feel like this is, even though this is on surface, can seem like dry, boring, bland history, we are told in Corinthians that this is given to us for our instruction, for our edification, for our reproof, for our understanding, for our application. In other words, to me, there's a dark warning in the failure of this Joash. What happened? He started out so well, and look at how bad he ended up.
Don't trust man, trust God.
Yeah, if he had his faith firmly entrenched in God, he wouldn't have been swayed by these wicked men, and in the end, he wouldn't have ended up murdering Jehoiada's son and going down in such disgrace. Yeah.
Well, it just, to me, sounds like he doesn't even know God, which I think a lot of Christians today don't actually know God.
Yeah, you're right. That's why I read about a different gospel, a different Jesus, a different spirit. In other words, people can be misled easily and think that they have their focus on the one true God when they really don't have a proper relationship ground in the one true God. It's either in something else or a program, or it could be any number of things. Right. Anybody have anyone? Let's go ahead.
Just one thing. I mean, you know, you're talking about the Twin Towers and the collapsing and how that's God's judgment, which, you know, I do believe that God allowed that to happen. But I also believe it's because of God's mercy. Because if you look at it, with as many people that were in those buildings, a lot more could have died.
Yeah.
And I think God's hand was on it because I think that act was something that he tried to use to wake people up. Too, because they're having tunnel vision in their own little worlds, and you know, he's trying to wake them up because he is merciful, because he is gracious, because he is loving, because he is long-suffering, and you know, that it's like you say, we should, you know, because we're man and we're fallen, we should reap that, but he doesn't want us to. So he's trying to show us through the things that are happening in this world that there is a different way.
You know, it's a really good point, because do you remember what the original estimate was, the number of people that were killed there? Originally?
Thousands. I don't know what it was.
What was it?
They were talking like 40,000 people.
50,000 people, they said, probably died there. Well, it ended up being 3. So you're absolutely right. It was really an act of God's mercy, and it's a good point because, you know, even though it was a judgment for God, it was a wake-up call from God. Look at how much worse it could have been. But not only that, when we went through the book of Revelation, we were dealing with the tribulation period. And the tribulation period, you know, it's just one huge odyssey of suffering and dying and death and carnage and destruction. But I oftentimes refer to it as not just the great tribulation, but I look at it as the great merciful tribulation, because it's in that tribulation that brings a multitude of mankind and from every nation, every language, and every tongue to a saving knowledge of God. Because as long, it's a sad fact, as long as our lives are halfway satisfactory to ourselves, everything's going on an even keel, a lot of times we can't be bothered with God or the things of God. You know, but we get smacked upside the head real hard with some real difficulties, real trials, and real tribulation in our life. Then, you know, we got nowhere to go but down on our knees, nowhere to look but up as far as prayer is concerned. Then we take God serious. And that's why, even though the tribulation has got to take place because God is going to judge the world and its sinners, it's an act of mercy. It really is, because in the tribulation, it'll motivate men to seek God like never before. Anybody have anyone else they want to add or share?